day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Carlyle Group fourth quarter 2015 earnings call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question and answer session, and instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require operator assistance during the conference, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your host for today's conference, Mr. Daniel Harris, Head of Investor Relations. Sir, you may begin.
Thank you, Chelsea. Good morning and welcome to Carlyle's fourth quarter and full year 2015 earnings call. In the room with me and on the call today is our Co-Chief Executive Officers, David Rubenstein and Bill Conway, and our Chief Financial Officer, Curt Buser. Early this morning, we issued a press release and detailed earnings presentation with our fourth quarter and full year results, a copy of which is available on the investor relations portion of our website. Following our remarks, we will hold a question and answer session for analysts and institutional investors. To ensure participation by all those on the call, please limit yourself to one question and return to the queue for any follow-ups. Please contact investor relations following this call with any additional questions. This call is being webcast, and a replay will be available on our website. We will refer to certain non-GAAP financial measures during today's call. These measures should not be considered in isolation from or as a substitute for measures prepared in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. We have provided a reconciliation of these measures to GAAP in our earnings release. Any forward-looking statements made today do not guarantee future performance, and undue reliance should not be placed on them. These statements are based on current management expectations and involve inherent risks and uncertainties, including those identified in the Risk Factors section of our annual report on Form 10-K, that could cause actual results to differ materially from those indicated. Carlyle assumes no obligation to update any forward-looking statements at any time. With that, let me turn it over to our Co-Chief Executive Officer, David Rubenstein.
Thank you, Dan. By almost every measure, and despite headwinds in various global equity and credit markets, we had a year that achieved many of our financial goals, highlighted by the production of outstanding distributions for our unit holders, as well as solid returns for our fund investors. However, despite this recent success in producing distributions for our unit holders, and despite a nearly 30-year history of generating exceptional returns for our fund investors, Carlyle's current equity market valuation does not, in our view, ascribe any reasonable value to our global investment franchise, our existing investments, or our significant growth opportunities. Therefore, in addition to announcing today what we consider to be quite solid annual financial results, we are also initiating a unit repurchase plan of up to $200 million. At anywhere near our current unit price, our units represent an incredibly attractive value, not only for public investors, but they also represent for Carlyle a highly accretive investment opportunity, and we have decided that we should take advantage of this opportunity while it exists. I will discuss this repurchase plan in more detail in a few moments. First, I would like to discuss a few other topics, our financial results and our fundraising progress. I'll provide a few thoughts about our unit price. On the financial results, in 2015, we invested $8.8 billion, and over the past 3 years, have now invested $27 billion into investments that we believe have the capacity to be as good as those we have exited over the past few years. For the year, we realized proceeds for our investors of $18.1 billion, and 2015 marked the fifth consecutive year that Carlyle has distributed between $17 billion and $20 billion back to our fund investors. During the year, we also raised $22.5 billion in gross new capital. We also produced more than $1 billion of distributable earnings, exclusive of an $80 million charge for an international tax matter in the first quarter of 2015, or $923 million inclusive of this charge. Overall, we believe these performance metrics highlight just how strong a year we had and how well-positioned we are for the future. I should add that the $1 billion of distributable earnings we earned in 2015 compares to $973 million in 2014 and $837 million in 2013. For the full year 2015, we will distribute $2.07 per common unit. With that distribution, we will have distributed $6.04 per unit to our unit holders over the past 3 years, and that is equal to about 50% of our current unit price. Over the past 3 years, we will also have distributed approximately $55 billion to our fund investors. For the fourth quarter, we invested $4 billion into new or follow-on investments, the the highest amount we have invested in a single quarter since the first quarter of 2011. During the quarter, we also realized $4 billion of proceeds for our fund investors, and we raised a gross $4.1 billion in capital for our funds. Our activity produced pre-tax distributable earnings of $145 million and a distribution per common unit of 29 cents for the quarter. As Bill will discuss in a moment, we have already signed a number of transactions which will lead to both an active investment and active exit pace in the first half of 2016. On fundraising, we have hit the hard caps on virtually every fund we have closed recently. The fundraising environment for our funds remains strong, for investors seem to increasingly sense that the more attractive asset pricing will emerge this year and perhaps as well over the next few years. Because of this investor sentiment and the recognition of our long track record, we expect our funds will continue to be well received by fund investors around the world. I should add that of the $22.5 billion in gross new capital we raised during 2015, we raised $14.5 billion for our carry funds, of which nearly 85% came from our existing fundraising base, and more than 15% came from investors new to Carlyle. Stated differently, our large existing investor base continues to invest significant amounts with us. We were also able to attract many new and significant investors. During the fourth quarter, we closed on our second-generation U.S. mid-cap buyout fund, closing at the hard cap of $2.4 billion. Our second fund was more than twice the size of our first fund, which has performed quite well. We have to date raised more than $2.7 billion for our second energy mezzanine fund, past our initial target of $2.5 billion, and twice the size of the first energy mezzanine fund. We're also now above the billion-dollar threshold for our second power fund. We expect to soon hold an initial close on AlpInvest's sixth secondaries fund and to have an additional close on our new Asian structured credit fund. And Metropolitan, our real estate fund of funds, has closed on $500 million for its latest secondaries fund. We're also working on our fourth-generation distressed debt fund, our fifth Asian growth fund, and our first U.S. Core Plus real estate fund. Further, we also closed three CLOs in the fourth quarter, totaling almost $1.5 billion. For 2016, despite not having our largest funds in the market, we still expect to raise new commitments of approximately $15 billion. Our fundraising success positions us exceptionally well, precisely at a time when new investments are likely to be available at more attractive prices. We now have dry powder of $58 billion across our platform. Of that amount, $44 billion is in our carry funds, which we anticipate being able to deploy into what we think will be an especially attractive set of upcoming opportunities in all asset classes across the globe. Let me now return to our unit price. At the risk of stating the obvious, no one at Carlyle and those who work at the firm own more than two-thirds of the total units finds the current unit price satisfactory or acceptable. And we take no comfort in the fact that the whole alternative investment industry, despite its many strengths, has seen a dramatic decline in unit prices over the past 6 months. That said, we are focused on our business, how to further strengthen that business and the market's perception of that business. Stated simply, we believe the market's concerns about our own future earnings capacity essentially overlook the value of our existing investments, our dry powder, our exit pipeline, and our track record of strong investment performance in up and down markets. In addition, we believe the market's perception seriously overlooks the positive characteristics which market volatility can, and we think will, have on our future earnings capacity. And we believe this because we have proven our ability to exit good investments even in difficult environments. We have also proven that during the market downturn such as this one, we have made some of our best investments, grown in size, and enhanced our future earnings power. Given the market's extremely low current valuation of our units, and given our interest in making investments which are well below our view of intrinsic value, we have decided to implement a repurchase program of up to $200 million. The program will be able to purchase both public and internal units, though the majority of the purchases will be focused on public units. We will begin to implement this program in the immediate future, and we will fund the program from available cash resources. Let me mention now two other steps we are also pursuing. First, we are committed to managing the firm and our fee-related earnings as efficiently as possible. To that end, we are intensifying our efforts to drive operational efficiency across the entire firm. We have already taken steps in this direction and will take more. For instance, compensation was lower in 2015 and non-compensation expenses have been generally flat for several years despite having a much broader investment platform with new investment capabilities. A second step I'd like to mention is this. We are committed to growing the firm by focusing our efforts on raising larger next vintage funds and by creating new funds of scale in areas where we have clear competitive advantages and deep institutional knowledge. For instance, Carlyle has been working for the past year on a creative long-term investment fund, one designed to make alternative investments which might profitably be held for longer periods than the normal 3 to 5 year private equity hold period. We have an experienced team in place to run this fund, which we have named Carlyle Global Partners. We've already invested more than $400 million in two investments through the fund, and we have also secured more than $3 billion in commitments from a limited number of well-known institutional investors. Two other examples in this vein are a new Core Plus Real Estate Fund, which should have its first close early this year, and a new infrastructure fund for developed markets, which will shortly be open to investors. Both of these funds build on our existing expertise in real estate, energy, and infrastructure, but the new funds with enhanced teams and more expansive focus should be able to scale into substantial businesses for Carlyle. To summarize my remarks, we are pleased with the cash we have distributed to our unit holders and fund investors in 2015. And to take advantage of an attractive investment opportunity, we will initiate the unit buyback program. But in addition to that program, our main focus remains on operating our company efficiently and continuing the production of healthy cash distributions for our unit holders and investors. We believe we can do this again in 2016. Bill?
Thank you, David. Let me begin with an overview of the increasingly uncertain investment environment. This environment is driven, in our judgment, by three primary and interrelated factors: China, crude, and credit. China is a country with an unprecedented 35-year track record of growth at an average rate of over 10% per year, from about $300 billion in 1980 to about $11 trillion in 2015. It is a country with over $3 trillion in foreign exchange reserves, a $500 billion per year trade surplus, and a large and fast-growing entrepreneurial sector. Growth has certainly slowed over the last year, below 7% by official estimates, in part because China is trying to make the difficult transition from an export-oriented, industrial-focused economy to one more oriented towards consumption and services. As that dramatic shift takes place, China is still growing at a rate that most countries would relish, but the global economy and financial markets are still coming to grips with the consequences of this lower level of growth. Regarding crude, everyone knows where crude prices have been and where they are, but no one knows where they're going. Recent experience confirms that futures prices tell where you can complete a transaction today, but not what the actual price will be on some future date. This ongoing uncertainty has greatly increased volatility in both equity and credit markets. And of course, unpredictability in the price of crude has spillover effects on the entire chain of energy production, transmission, storage, and consumption. On credit, effective interest rates on new senior secured loans in the United States are up on average between 50 and 100 basis points over the past 6 months, with yields on senior unsecured notes have risen by more than 200 basis points. The average bid price on outstanding senior secured loans has also fallen from 97 for $100 of par in June of 2015 to 90 today. Overall, loan origination volume fell by more than one-third on a quarter-to-quarter basis during the fourth quarter of 2015. And paper losses on energy and mineral and mining credits have been so large that credit providers, particularly in the U.S., are exercising extraordinary caution in providing new credits in all sectors. Compounding this challenge, dealer inventories of corporate debt are less than half the levels of 10 years ago, leading to sharp price adjustments for both buyers and sellers. Credit is definitely tighter. We believe good transactions can and will continue to be financed in this environment. Taken together, these three factors have produced enormous uncertainty across global financial markets, and we believe they will lead to significant volatility for the foreseeable future, with the risk tilted to the downside. In addition to global economic factors, we are also highly attuned to feedback from our portfolio. While each company is unique, our fund heads, with only a few exceptions, report that their portfolios are somewhat weaker on average than they were 6 months ago, with the most impacted sector being industrials. In challenging conditions, the advantages of identifying and supporting strong management teams become more important than ever. Time after time, average managers complain about the environment and struggle, but the best ones find a way to do much, much better than their competitors. We have always considered management as the most important factor in determining investment success, and while every transaction won't meet our objectives, we have great confidence in the teams and businesses with whom we partner. We expect a tougher environment over the next few years, but it is in this environment that we expect to see the best opportunities. For the past 2 years, we have highlighted the challenge of high asset values and the impact that has had on our investment pace. We think today and in the near future, from a new deal standpoint, valuations will be more to our liking. In terms of our performance, overall valuations were up about 2% quarter over quarter and 7% year over year, driven primarily by our public market positions, which were up 7% for the quarter and 13% for the year. For the full year of 2015, our bio funds were up 13%, our real estate funds appreciated 27%, while most of our energy funds were lower. In terms of investments, we invested about $4 billion in the fourth quarter, with the largest transaction representing only about 11% of the total. Overall, we executed 46 new transactions across 19 different funds, demonstrating the breadth of our platform. Specifically, we made several investments in Europe, including Innovation Group and PA Consulting, both in the UK. We invested in several new transactions in China, including Tongyi Lubricants, which we acquired from Shell, Sufeng.com, which is like Zillow for China real estate, and JIC Leasing. We acquired Novetta in the U.S., an advanced analytics solutions provider. And in our mid-market buyout fund, we closed 5 new transactions. We are starting to invest more of our dry powder in natural resources, as many energy firms need cash to just survive and certainly to carry out new programs. Our energy mezzanine funds partnered with Hilcorp, one of the largest privately held oil and gas developers in the U.S., on a range of new assets. Our Power Fund invested in Rhode Island State Energy Center, and NGP invested more than $350 million in new and follow-on opportunities. Overall, natural resources and energy investments were over $800 million for the quarter. Finally, we continue to be active investing in U.S. real estate opportunities, putting more than $250 million in equity to work. Looking forward, we have closed or announced a number of transactions early in the year, including Veritas, which we closed on January 29. Despite some hurdles, we were able to complete this transaction with satisfactory terms for all parties. On exits, in the fourth quarter of last year, we closed on NXP's acquisition of Freescale, about $1.3 billion in real estate sales and operating proceeds, the sale of Kbro, a cable provider in Taiwan. We also completed a number of block trades, including Healthscope, Booz Allen, CoreSight, India Infoline, and XDEP. We had 3 companies go public in the quarter: Tsubaki Nakashima in Japan, Multi Packaging Solutions in the U.S., and Focus Media in China. One might ask whether our exit or investment pace might slow down given the turmoil in public markets. Without providing guidance, I note that we have a long list of trade sales and realizations in process, which are scheduled to close in the first half of the year. The year is also off to a strong start in terms of new investments. As of early February, we already have signed contracts for approximately $4 billion of new investments and $4 billion of realized proceeds, all of which we expect to complete during the first half of the year. And our investment professionals continue to search every day for attracting new investment opportunities and exit opportunities. As mentioned earlier, we foresee a tougher environment ahead, with volatility caused by China, crude, and credit, and amid other factors. We are cautious with all new investments, but we are excited to have $44 billion in carry fund dry powder. Given our global reach, industry expertise, and experienced investment teams, we expect to find attractive opportunities to put this money to work. Let me now turn it over to Curt Buser.
Thank you, Bill. Before diving into the numbers, I want to highlight four key themes. First, we continue to focus on generating cash earnings. Our results for 2015 substantiate this with pre-tax distributable earnings for the year of $923 million. This enabled total 2015 distributions of $2.07 to our unit holders. Second, our portfolio is well positioned to continue to realize performance fees. Our largest carry-generating funds are solidly in carry. U.S. Buyout 5, Europe Buyout 3, Asia Buyout 3, and U.S. Real Estate 6 would each need to fall more than 40% in fair value to fall out of accrued carry from their fourth quarter valuations. On the exit front, Bill has already mentioned several of our larger announced transactions waiting to close, but I further point out that as of the end of 2015, we had more than $23 billion of our $60 billion in remaining fair value that was deployed before 2012, with many of those older investments ripe for monetization. Third, we continue to focus on managing our cost structure. We previously expected cash compensation in 2015 to be nominally higher than 2014, but in fact, cash compensation in 2015 was down 5% from 2014. We expect to be similarly vigilant on compensation in 2016. Similar to the fourth quarter of 2014, we had lower fourth quarter compensation due to paying relatively lower year-end bonuses than previously anticipated. General administrative expense has not materially changed in 3 years, despite the fact that the firm has grown substantially over this time period and compliance demands are even greater. Further evidence of our focus on efficiency. We are also managing non-cash compensation expenses. Although equity compensation increased to $122 million in 2015 from $80 million in 2014, which reflects incremental vesting of annual grants, we have granted fewer units in each of the past 2 years to our employees. These cost initiatives should enable us to maintain fee-related earnings in 2016 at a quarterly average relatively consistent with the $43 million we produced in this quarter, even with lower expected fee revenues in 2016. Fourth, during the current quarter, we activated fees on several key funds, including our second energy mezzanine fund, our second U.S. middle market buyout fund, and NGP's 11th fund, in total adding about $8 billion to fee-earning assets under management as of year-end. Prior quarters, we have referred to these funds as pending fee-earning AUM, which we define simply as capital commitments that will earn fees once activated or invested. However, in the fourth quarter, the impact on management fees was limited given the late quarter fee activation. After activating these funds, our pending fee-earning assets under management declined to $4.5 billion from $12.5 billion last quarter. Now, let's turn to a review of our business segments, but as we do so, keep in mind that included in our general administrative and other expenses for both U.S. GAAP and economic net income for the fourth quarter is a $50 million reserve for ongoing litigation and contingencies that is excluded from fee-related earnings and distributable earnings. Corporate private equity. Corporate private equity had another strong year with distributable earnings of $798 million. Up $8 million over 2014, reflecting higher net realized performance fees and lower fee-related earnings compared to a year ago. Fee-related earnings in corporate private equity were $106 million in 2015, down $23 million from $129 million in 2014. The decline in fee-related earnings was primarily driven by a $44 million decrease in transaction fees. Now, we expect to improve in 2016, but not to 2014 levels. We effectively managed expenses in corporate private equity to offset this decline in fees. For the fourth quarter, fee-related earnings were $17 million compared to $33 million in the year-ago period. Catch-up management fees were nominal in the current quarter compared to $7 million in the same period a year ago. I previously mentioned that catch-up management fees, beginning in the fourth quarter of 2015, would slow from their prior levels. We expect them to remain low until our next generation of large bio funds return to the market. Turning to global market strategies, GMS used 2015 to position its business for growth in 2016. As of today, we've raised over $2.7 billion for our second energy mezzanine fund. The full impact of management fees from that fund will show up in first quarter results. In addition, during 2015, we built out our investment team to deploy a larger energy mezzanine complex on a global basis and expanded our distressed debt investing team in advance of what we expect will be a successful fundraise for our fourth fund. We also continue to grow our BDC and our CLO businesses. Thus, while management fee revenue declined 19% in GMS during 2015, cash compensation declined only 4% as we continue to invest in growth areas. Distributable earnings in global market strategies declined in 2015 due to the build-out of the business, as I described, and from lower hedge fund-related assets under management. Hedge fund AUM declined to $8.3 billion as of the end of 2015, compared to $13.4 billion as of the end of 2014. And we expect AUM runoff of approximately $3.1 billion in 2016 as redeemed assets are sold and returned to investors. Our significant hedge funds remain below their high-water marks, though they are performing better, and certain niche strategies contribute the majority of the $8 million of realized incentive fees GMS earned in the quarter. Moving on to real assets. Real assets had a great year, producing distributable earnings of $153 million, exclusive of the international tax matter, and $51 million in the fourth quarter alone. For 2015, fee-related earnings increased to $72 million from $22 million in 2014, largely owing to the successful raise of our seventh U.S. real estate fund, our second power fund, and soon to be enhanced by the incremental fees we'll earn on activating fees on NGP 11. Real assets benefited from $24 million in catch-up management fees in 2015, compared to $8 million in 2014. Again, with lower fundraising in real assets in 2016, we expect catch-up management fees to decline from 2015 levels. In investment solutions, our financial results in 2015 were well below 2014. The decrease in distributable earnings during 2015 was largely a function of lower management fees, $27 million lower than 2014, driven by lower average assets under management from the negative impact of foreign exchange rates, as well as the runoff in certain AlpInvest and DGAM products. We expect a continued runoff at AlpInvest of commitments from its former owners of approximately $10 billion over the next 5 years. However, the revenue impact is expected to be offset with raising higher yielding fee-earning assets under management over the same period and continued expense management in other areas of investment solutions on which we expect to have more to report in the near future. Now, one final thought on fee-earning assets under management. Fee-earning AUM of $131 billion increased from $128 billion at the beginning of the quarter due principally to the activation of fees on $8 billion of assets under management, partially offset by distributions from healthy realizations in the quarter. Looking forward, keep in mind that all fee-earning AUM is not equally profitable. We currently have approximately $16 billion of fee-earning assets from our legacy energy funds and AlpInvest that will run off over the next 5 years, which could mask growth in other areas. However, this AUM has a relatively low fee yield for Carlyle and is not a material driver of our results. With that, let me turn it back to David for some closing comments.
In sum, we believe that Carlyle had a strong year in 2015 and is well positioned to build on last year's record in 2016. Indeed, we believe the likely market headwinds and associated global economic challenges should actually present opportunities from which Carlyle is well positioned to benefit, and as we have during similar times in the past. We're now ready to take your questions.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the star and then the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. To allow everyone the opportunity to participate, we ask that you please limit yourself to one question before pressing star one again to reenter the queue. Thank you. Our first question comes from the line of Ken Worthington with J.P. Morgan. Your line is now open.
Hi, good morning. Can you talk about your thoughts on deploying dry powder you have dedicated to energy, maybe expanding on the comments on energy mezz? To what extent are you starting to see willing sellers or maybe indication of pending willingness to sell at what could be, you know, reasonably attractive prices for Carlyle? And given the stress in that market, to what extent would you expect faster than historic deployment? I think you tend to deploy 4 to 5 years in the private equity carry funds. Is 3 to 4 or maybe even faster reasonable or even expected here? And then lastly, financing. Are you able to borrow to get the deals done if all the other pieces come together? Thank you.
Okay, Ken, this is Bill. First of all, I would say that the gap between buyers and sellers is narrowing in terms of energy transactions. I think, you know, people who need money, they are more desperate as time has passed. And I think it's sinking in that these low prices might be here for a long time. I would not say that we're in any way calling a bottom, that yesterday's price was the bottom and it's all up from here, or that the bottom is $20 or some other number. We're not making a projection on that. I do think that relative, obviously, historically to the recent history, and what I expect to be a little longer run future, that prices will be higher 5 years from now than they are today, but, you know, we don't know that. I do think that we probably will deploy the money a little quicker than the 4 to 5 year period of time, but obviously it's going to be a function of the deals we see. I would also say that the energy platform is a very varied platform. And by that I mean we have power funds. We have a power fund. We're on a second one now. We've raised over $1 billion for that. It just recently announced a deal to buy 11 power plants, natural gas fired primarily. And so that's a deal that perhaps is not considered one that might be as risky as somebody doing E&P off the coast of Hawaii or something like that. I would say that our second business in energy, we have the International Energy Fund. We have an outstanding team running that business. It gets a chance to see opportunities all over the world. So far, its focus has tended to be a little more on the downstream market. So it's got a very good position in storage and refining in Europe. Arguably, some of the best sectors, frankly, in the energy sector. E&P, a lot of that's done through NGP. They've begun to both support their existing portfolio companies as well as, you know, looking for new opportunities there as well, being very cautious. I think they're staying primarily in the lowest cost geographies, like the Permian Basin would be an outstanding example of that. I'd say I was happy with the $800 million or so that we put to work in the energy platform last quarter as the gap narrows between buyers and sellers. And I think that we will hopefully be able to continue a pace somewhere in that range. In terms of financing, I would say that financing generally, I made a comment on in my prepared remarks, that while definitely tougher and more expensive, that for the right deal it can get done. In energy, it's less certain that that is the case. The providers of credit to energy are obviously they've been very badly burned, and you know, most of the reserve-based loans really struggle. Just it's been a people who thought they were on the bottom 6 months or 12 months ago and put money to work really kind of regret it now. And I think that financing, let's say that we were to do a buyout type transaction that related to the energy industry, I think it would be tough to raise the kind of money we used to raise, but I think you could raise something and just be a lot lower quanta and probably a lot higher price.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And our next question comes from the line of Brennan Hawken with UBS. Your line is now open.
Thanks for taking the question. I believe, Bill, you referenced that there's some deterioration seen in the environment for some of your industrial companies. I was hoping maybe you could give a little bit more color on that and whether or not the source of that or that's limited to companies that either have a large customer base in the oil patch or in emerging market economies, or whether it goes beyond that. If you could help us maybe flesh that out a bit, that'd be great.
Sure. Well, what I tried to say was that I did a survey of my of 20 or so of my fund heads and asked them a five-part question. Compared to 6 months ago, is your portfolio about the same, somewhat weaker, a lot weaker, or about the same, somewhat stronger, a lot stronger? And the general consensus was that the portfolio was somewhat weaker. I would say that was not consistent. There were some parts, for example, one of the energy funds thought that their portfolio was actually in a little better shape now. And so it's that was a fund that had certain exposure to the downstream segment, I would point out. The industrial impact, what's happened really is that the dramatic fall in the price of crude from over 100 to under 30, while we keep waiting to see benefits on the consumer side, and perhaps there are some, like the sale of 18 million automobiles in the United States as an example. You know, it's hard to imagine we have a weak industrial sector with car sales at an all-time high, but it's kind of what we see. I would say most of the industrial companies that are referenced in terms of being weaker do have exposure to either the energy sector or to emerging markets.
Okay, thanks for that.
Thank you. And our next question comes from the line of Robert Lee with KBW. Your line is now open.
Thank you. I'm just curious on kind of the new product front or new strategy front. I mean, you highlighted a couple of the initiatives, Core Plus, Infrastructure, Carlyle Global Partners. But I'm just curious what your appetite is at this point for looking outside the firm for expansion. I mean clearly, in a few years back, you had going down the hedge fund route, and there was AlpInvest, and I guess maybe more mixed results, from a bunch of those. So, has your appetite for looking outside the firm for new strategies or new opportunities, change from what it was several years ago, and maybe more focused, even more focused internally on trying to, develop new strategies, trying to get a feel for that?
This is David. We have had some pretty good success in buying some things that we're quite happy with. NGP is a very good example of an investment we've made that we're quite happy with. AlpInvest has also done quite well. We would be opportunistic. We don't have a checklist of things we say we have to buy, but we are approached all the time, and we are willing to look at things. But I think it's fair to say, from the inference from your question, that we are very focused on starting new funds where we can basically develop professionals to run those funds by recruiting them, or we have people we've grown internally, and we have them start a new fund. Clearly, it's much less expensive at the outset to do that, and we've had a lot of success with doing that. So the funds we emphasized prepared remarks were really ones that were generating internally, but I wouldn't say we wouldn't buy something externally. We just have to take a look at whether it fits what we generally think we have expertise in. But I wouldn't read too much into what we said we're starting now, because we wouldn't preclude doing something else, but I do feel we're very happy with the idea of starting new funds. It's a little bit less expensive to get them off the ground, and you don't have to worry about cultural fit so much, because usually we have people that are part of our culture that we're starting these with generally. But so those are three that we focused on today, but there will be others, no doubt, that we'll be talking about in the future.
Great. And maybe more specifically on Carlyle Global Partners, I think you mentioned have raised about $3 billion of commitments so far for this kind of more long duration, long dated PE style investments. Is that kind of where you expect it to kind of cap out, for lack of a better way of putting it, at this point, or is it really just more as opportunities arise, you'll just kind of go to your group of investors at that point? Just trying to get a sense of how big you think that type of product can become.
Well, we think there are a number of investors with whom we are in discussion now that are likely to add to that sum. I don't want to state a specific dollar amount as a cap, but we expect it will get bigger at some point during this year. We think this is a different type of investment product, much longer term, and as it gets to be better known over a period of years, this is something that I think a lot of other investors will be interested in. But right now, it's a limited number of very large sovereign wealth funds, international pension funds, public pension funds in the U.S. that are interested in this. I suspect over a period of time, you'll see a broader array of investors interested in this as the rates of return that are appealing become more apparent.
Okay, thanks. Just one last question. I mean, I guess maybe you touched on sovereign wealth funds, but certainly it's been a lot written about, you know, oil-based sovereigns having to, you know, pull back investments to fund budget deficits and whatnot. So just curious if you're seeing any impact on your business in the sense of, you know, new commitments from oil-based sovereign funds, or you haven't really seen much change at this point. Just any color on that?
Yes. I was just in the Gulf not long ago, and I met with a lot of our longtime investors there. And honestly, I did not see them pulling back on investing with us because, you know, the rates of return you can get alternatives are pretty high. And we're still a small amount of the money that they overall have because their overall allocations to alternatives are probably, you know, in a single digit still. So I didn't really see that. But I want to point out that, you know, there are a lot of sovereign wealth funds that we're getting money from now that are not from the Middle East. And now you're seeing an enormous number of sovereign wealth funds from Asia that are increasingly becoming more important to us. So overall, the impact on us for what's going on in the Middle East, our fund rate isn't significant, but I haven't yet seen the large sovereign wealth funds in the Middle East pulling back from commitments to us, at least.
Great. Thanks for taking my questions.
Thank you. And as a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question at this time, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Again, we do ask that you please limit yourself to one question before pressing star 1 again to re-enter the queue. And our next question comes from the line of Patrick David with Autonomous. Your line is now open.
Hi, good morning, guys. You know, Japan has obviously been in the news a lot, and I think you guys are probably the most established presence there. Could you give us an idea of, I guess, one exposure? Is it just the specific Japanese funds, or are there positions in other funds? And then maybe some broader color on what stresses you're seeing, and then to what extent you think the opportunity could get that much bigger, given what's happening there.
In Japan?
Yes.
Well, Ms. Bill, I'd say that We have a great team in Japan. We've been there a long time. Over, I think we get about 20 investment professionals. Actually, we tend to raise a lot of money for the Japanese fund in Japan. Typically, more than half the money for the Japanese fund comes from Japanese investors. We've had excellent deal flow there. I'd say that's one of the parts of our business that's reporting that their pipeline is strong. And we see good transactions that are coming there. We were happy, for example, last year at the end of the year to get the IPO of Sabaki Makishima done in the Japanese markets. I don't really have a comment on their move to negative interest rates or, you know, the three arrows of the Japanese government or whatever. I think the Japanese are a very determined group of people as a whole, and certainly the Carlyle investment teams in Japan are very determined group. I like what I see in our deal flow, and I actually like the position we have, which tends to be, I think, the most established firm in Japan, and that helps us see pretty much every opportunity that's there. I think also over time there's been a little bit of a I'd say, more growing acceptance of private equity in Japan. That in the early days, you know, you saw this second or third largest economy in the world, $5 trillion economy, and you thought, and with all the great attributes they had, you thought there'd be a lot more business to be done in Japan. I'd say in the last couple of years, more acceptance by the big Japanese companies, the big global firms, to dealing with private equity and using private equity as a partial solution to their attempts to refocus their business. I like our position in Japan, and I think it's I think there's some question about how much bigger can it really get than it is. I'd like to think over the next few years it could double in size, but we'll see if we can do that.
Great, thanks.
Thank you. And our next question comes from the line of Michael Kim with Sandler O'Neill. Your line is now open.
Hey guys, good morning. So just coming back to the buyback, if I've got the math right, looks like the authorization represents north of 20% of the stock's public float. So just wondering if your thinking may have changed in terms of sort of longer-term goal of improving the stock's liquidity, and then as it relates to the $200 million, just curious sort of the thinking behind that amount, particularly as it relates to still earmarking capital for ongoing GP commitments, investment spending, and maybe potential M&A opportunities.
Well, 2 points. First, we thought we could readily afford the $200 million out of available cash, and therefore we felt comfortable with that amount. We do not feel it will crimp our ability to start new initiatives. We wouldn't have pursued it at that level if we thought it would have. So we're comfortable with our ability to fund it. We didn't say how long it would take to invest it. We don't know yet. It will be opportunistic. We'll see what opportunities come up to buy the shares of the units at these prices. And clearly, you know, we're ready to implement this. We haven't announced a formula by internal versus external, as some of our peers did, but as I mentioned in my prepared remarks, we expect the majority of this would go for external units. We are always sensitive to our float. We probably have a smaller float than some of our peers, and so we're not particularly interested in reducing our float. However, the price of the units was so low and so appealingly low to as an investor that we just really couldn't resist buying it at these prices that we currently see. But we are sensitive to the float issue, and we do think in time that this will not materially affect our ability to have a reasonable and a very attractive float.
Okay. Thanks for taking my question.
Thank you. And our next question comes from the line of Mike Carrier with Bank of America Merrill Lynch. Your line is now open.
All right, thanks a lot. Maybe a question, just focusing on distributable earnings and the distribution. So I think when I look at what Brent said in terms of the FRE outlook, it looks like there should be some more consistency, you know, for, you know, 2016, you know, based on what you guys can see. I guess on the portfolio, you've locked in a few things up front, but just, you know, wanted to kind of get a gauge of when you have more volatility like this, can you still pursue, you know, some exits given the seasoning, you know, the portfolio? And then lastly, just given, you know, the buyback, does the payout, you know, ratio change? And I guess what I'm trying to get at is there any way to put a wide range out there, you know, given what you did in 2015 on the low end, you know, around FRE, you know, and then on the high end, a pretty good environment, you know, where that could come out? And obviously, I know it's a bit of a challenge given the moving parts.
Let me start with that, but I think both David and Kurt may jump in as well. To get into some direct questions in there, there's no anticipation this will cause us to adjust the payout ratio. We still expect that will stay as is. We look at DE, and we're not really going to be in a position to forecast what's going to happen with DE. And I think in terms of fee-related earnings, Kurt made the comment in his remarks about the rough level of those earnings. Maybe let me turn over to Kurt.
So, Mike, you know, as I said in my remarks,
we're expecting next year from the fee-related earnings standpoint to look an awful lot like the current quarter. There'll be, gives and takes and whatnot, but, kind of think, 40 to mid-40s per quarter FRE on average. From a looking at our exit pace in terms of total distributable earnings, it's really hard to call a number, that one's just difficult. That said, think about the $4 billion of exits that we have under contract already, and those are, essentially, private deals. It's not, public block sales or anything like that. If you think about what we have done historically, $17 to $20 billion per year returned to our investors over the last 5 years. We returned cash of $6 or $6.04 over the last 3 years in distributions to our unit holders. So, we have consistently performed. As everybody knows, each quarter can be, some can be really high and some can be a little low, but each quarter for the last 5 years, we've performed well in good times and in bad, and I don't see any reason why that should really fundamentally change.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you. And our next question comes from the line of Alex Blostein with Goldman Sachs. Your line is now open.
Thanks. Good morning, everybody. Bill, I want to go back to the point you made earlier around financing availability. So credit markets are clearly a little tighter, as you mentioned, but your ability to execute what sort of quote-unquote good deals is still there. I was hoping you could extrapolate on that a little bit. What is a good deal in today's environment, whether geographies or sectors or size or any of the financing terms, so kind of, leverage, et cetera, would be helpful.
Sure. Well, as you and I both know, each deal is unique. So a generalization should be treated as just a generalization, if I could make that obvious point. I would say that in terms of what will be doable today, for the last couple of quarters, total leverage of 6x EBITDA was kind of pretty possible across most sectors. However, I would say I expect that to go down in the near future. Not maybe for the best deals, maybe not for a a media deal or a cable deal or a tower deal. They may still get a pretty good size leverage ratio, but I expect others will go down. I expect that the caps that banks ask for and the extra, let's say, leeway they might have in pricing the deal, I expect those to broaden out as well. It's hard to blame the lenders for that, given the extent to which they've been burned or could be burned in the future by existing inventory they may have. I would say that the U.S. market is substantially tighter so far than the European market in terms of quanta, mainly, I would say, and in terms of, now you can do bigger deals in the United States, but in terms of the ratio of EBITDA. People can say, well, the European banks haven't faced their past problems or this or that, but generally, in the European market, we're finding that a little easier to get things financed there. I think Mr. Draghi is probably going to be very, very committed to loosening in Europe. It's hard for me to believe that the euro's back at 115. And I would think that there'd be attempts to drive that down, which would be pretty good for financing. I would say that energy-related credits, which I touched on before, and mineral and mining credits, those are going to be tough to finance. Different banks may have different allocations across their platform, how much energy exposure they're willing to take, whatever. I think energy financing is going to be very tough to get as a general rule. And, that will just lead to either more equity financing or fewer deals to be done. I think it's a good opportunity for our energy mezzanine business. Some of the statistics that are currently available on rates and financing are kind of a little bit outdated. Somebody agreed to a deal some time ago. There was a pricing. There was a spread. There was a quanta. There were covenants. And there weren't covenants. I think that those deals are now coming to market, or they were locked in. And so I expect that there will be, for example, I also expect a bigger push on covenants. For the last year or so, about 70% of all the transactions done had effectively no covenants. And I think that the banks will begin to push back and insist on covenants as for a lot of deals going forward.
Let me add 2 points to that, Bill. There were a lot of discussion about covenant-like deals before the Great Recession, but actually, before the Great Recession, only about 20 to 25% of loans, leveraged loans, had covenant-like provisions. It rose up, as Bill said, to about 70% now, and that could change, I think, in the future. In addition, I would say that one other thing you're likely to see is greater equity contribution requirements. In 2015, the average equity contribution to a buyout was about 42%, up from about 39% in 2014 and up from 37% in 2013. I think, therefore, in leveraged buyouts, you're likely to see probably in the low to mid-40s as the average equity requirement now to get a buyout financed by the banks.
One thing just to pile on. Just remind everybody, our investment track record is very good. We have not changed our underwriting criteria. We have 700 investment professionals around the globe looking to deploy capital. In the fourth quarter, we deployed $4 billion. That was in over 40 transactions with no, single deal being really above like 10 or 11% of that number. So, as I look at kind of the real thing is, can we deploy capital and can we, generate performance? I think we can. And then as we continue to look at kind of the credit markets, just keep in mind that it's not just a U.S.-only focus. Credit markets in Europe are open right now, and a lot of our activity has been both in Europe and in Asia.
Got it. Lots of very helpful color there, guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And our next question comes from the line of Chris Kotowski with Oppenheimer. Your line is now open.
I guess my question is, if financing markets are constrained, and especially obviously in resource, I guess isn't the obvious next move then to do kind of leverage-in-place transactions where you either equitize an over-levered company or distress for control? And I'm curious, what is your appetite and experience with that? It's not what I would think of as a typical Carlyle deal.
Well, I think we have done deals like that in the past, where we would inject equity into a company, a so-called PIPE, a private investment in public equity. Might do that if it could be transformative or perhaps if it would help facilitate an acquisition. An example of that, at least where it was facilitative, not so much where there's too much debt on the company, was a couple of years ago when we did Genesee and Wyoming Railroad, where we were able to make a large investment into the equity of the company. It facilitated a big acquisition that Genesee and Wyoming did. We ended up making a lot of money on the transaction. So there are examples of a willingness to do that, and I wouldn't be surprised if there'll be more of them going forward.
Okay, and would that be typically a credit fund investment or a private equity type fund investment?
I would say it could be either. The private equity funds did it in the case of Genesee and Wyoming. They tend to be bigger than our credit funds, so that's a factor as well. But our credit funds also can invest throughout the capital structure usually, so they'll do some of that as well.
Okay.
Often that's when they do it, though, I would say. It's they can sometimes do either loan to control or equity to control a business in the, let's say, distressed businesses.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you. And our next question comes from the line of Bill Katz with Citi. Your line is now open.
Okay, thanks very much. Just coming back to the buyback discussion, and thanks for the earlier caller, could you talk a little bit about how you sort of weighed in your mind, I think one of your peers announced that it's sort of a Dutch tender, if you thought about that, because on one hand you're sort of suggesting the stock price is rather cheap, on the other hand, you're sort of monitoring the float dynamics here and sound opportunistic. So I guess with the stock where it is, A, why would you be opportunistic now, and why not, really drive the accretion by doing this up front? And then I guess underneath that, how do you think about just sort of the mix between internal versus external shares?
Bill, it's Kurt. Hey, thanks for the question. So we've been frustrated with our unit price for some time now. And so, concerns around flow and everything else was a reason for not acting sooner. And now just where the price has moved to, it's time to put our money where our mouth is. and step up, and we think this is a good move for the company. It's accretive too for all of the existing investors. So I think this is a smart move at this point in time. In terms of the actual mechanics, I fully expect that the vast majority of this is going to be purchased in the open market from the public over time. And we're working on the exact, you know, type of grids and the like that we'll put in place, but really don't see a big splash right up front. We'll do that, you know, more over time. But, you know, as you can see by the $200 million, it's a sizable amount.
Well, Paul Blair, thank you very much.
Thank you. And our next question comes from the line of Michael Cyprys with Morgan Stanley. Your line is now open.
Hi, good morning. Just following up on your remarks earlier about that you're committed to operational efficiency across the firm and focused on raising larger scale funds, can you just talk to how this is a change from what you've been doing in the past and what sort of efficiencies can we expect? And then just on the fee-related earnings margin, what sort of FRE margin can we expect over the next few years relative to the 15% that you hit in the quarter?
On the fund part, let me just address that part first. Our business model over many, many years has been to see if we can find an investment area that we can find some expertise in and raise money for and invest well in. Some of those areas have been appealing in terms of an internal rate of return investment operation, but they haven't been scaled. So we have some funds that, you know, let's say we have an Ireland fund, a very good fund, they're doing quite well, but it hasn't scaled yet, and maybe because of the size of Ireland, it may not scale. But I think in the future, we're more likely to look for new products where we think in the first fund we can scale it at a pretty good size, but the second and third fund are likely to scale much more. And so we'll probably be more judicious in looking for scalable products in the beginning. That's part of what we were trying to talk about there.
Sure. Michael, just to, you know, in terms of operational efficiency, you know, it's an area that we've been focused on. A lot of it comes to investment in technology and data management. This is something that we've been focused on for a while. You know, early on it was with basic, you know, things in terms of just basic accounting systems, you know, really to drive, you know, both, you know, reporting as a public company, but also then providing the type of information that our fund investors need and, quite frankly, you know, expect. But beyond that, it really gets to how you set that up and really having very good data management and having that drive, that can do a lot in terms of taking people costs out of the equation, and that's where we've been very focused. Second point along that is how you think about issues. And you got to think about issues front to back in terms of how they affect costs. So you can't just think about it from a siloed perspective within the organization. You got to think about it holistically, and we continue to make progress on that front to be able to think about costs front to back to be able to get, you know, better, you know, efficiency out of it. And then, as David said, you know, it's scale. It's how do we kind of get the right scale in each of the businesses. I don't think that you're going to see over time big movements in our margins, in part because, you know, our DNA is growth. And so we're going to continue to invest in new products and new opportunities. And so that's going to always come with a lower margin or essentially an investment period of expenses up front. And that will mask really the profitability of the higher performing products and the, you know, higher margin products. So overall, I mean, that's the model that we've set up, but we are clearly focused on driving better efficiency, and fortunately that's proven true in the past 12 months.
Now, I would add that as we run the firm, we've always said we run the firm for the investors in our funds, and they are quite happy with what we're doing in terms of rates of return and multiples and invested capital and so forth, and we think that's the lifeblood of the firm, is making certain that we continue to raise money on a growing basis from our investors around the world. We think in time, as our business matures a bit in certain areas, the margins will perhaps get better, but we always want to make certain we're doing the right thing for our fund investors and giving them new products and making sure the returns are good are what we really are all about.
Great, thank you.
Thank you, and our next question comes from the line of Brian Bedell with Deutsche Bank. Your line is now open.
Great. Thanks for taking my questions. Back to the realization backdrop, you know, obviously if the markets remain volatile and tricky, Bill, can you comment a little bit more about what you see as the potential for, you know, for M&A pipelines, you know, for your comp- for for your portfolio companies, and sort of contrast that with your willingness to stay patient and get better valuations down the road for exits.
Thanks. That's a great question. I would say that I have not seen yet a dramatic increase in the M&A opportunities I've seen from our portfolio companies. There's been maybe a little bit more activity in the U.S. there, but not a dramatic growth. You would think that some of those companies are in very good shape. Some of them are public. They have lots of sources of cash, and they would be looking at getting growth through acquisition. But I'd say no torrent of activity there at this point in time.
And so your preference, I guess, in these valuations, given current valuations and the potential for the market getting a little worse, you'd rather remain patient for exits over time, I would assume? Is that a fair?
Well, I would say on exits or on the new deals?
On exits.
Well, without doing your work for you, we had at December 31 a public portfolio of about $14 billion. And obviously, we're not immune to what happens in the public markets, and some of those shares in that public portfolio have fallen in value. And I'm not anxious to exit those investments, and I think that there could be some reduction in block trade activity if prices stay low, but who knows what will happen and what the attractive prices will be. So I'm going to be patient there. Private market prices haven't dropped yet, and so we've had a significant number of private transactions in the pipeline. And in terms of private exits, I referenced in my remarks $4 billion, but let me tell you some of the names that are in there and the types of companies that are there, and they're all over the world. There's a hotel company in Europe called B&B, has hundreds of hotels in France, Germany, and Italy that we have agreed to sell to a fellow competitor in that business, I would say, certainly a strategic buyer. We sold Landmark, which is a big FBO in the United States and around the world, to one of its competitors and people that are strategic buyers. We sold Cabro last year. We've agreed to sell EBC this year. They're both Taiwanese cable TV businesses in a private transaction. Sold WorldStrides, which is a company in our mid-market fund, which we've agreed to sell. And finally, we agreed to sell RAC to CVC, which is RAC is kind of the AAA of the UK. And we've sold half of it about a year or so ago. We're selling another half now to CVC, and that's what we think is an attractive price. So the private pipeline so far continues to be pretty active. I think you can't have a situation where you have lousy credit markets and you have equity markets plummeting where people, they won't undoubtedly, if those continue, which I hope they won't, but where there will be some diminution in the number of transactions, but we are off to a great start.
And I'll add that our U.S. real estate platform, which was a nice contributor to realized performance fees in 2015, most of its exits are on a private basis in individual properties, and so that's a very good pipeline of continued exits.
And I would say also on the energy side of things, I don't think we're a seller of many energy assets at this price. Certainly the E&P side, we're not. On the downstream, we've got a lot of investments in that sector, and if people want exposure to us and are willing to pay us a big number, they know our phone number.
Mm-hmm. Right. Thanks. That's great color. Thanks very much.
Thank you. And we do have a follow-up question from the line of Patrick Davitt with Autonomous. Your line is now open.
Hey, thanks for the follow-up. On the commentary about having to put, more than 40% equity in, and then I guess you got the Veritas deal done with having to put a little bit more equity in. How do we think about, your expected?
Those were generic numbers. I was referring to the industry-wide number, but okay, go ahead.
No, I realize that, but you did have to put more equity in the Veritas, right? So I guess the question is around how you didn't.
That's not correct, but I would say that the ratio went up. The deal all along had $2.6 billion of equity from Carlyle and our co-investors and GIC in connection with doing the deal. When the price went down, the equity component stayed the same. So we didn't put more equity in, except we put more equity in as a percentage of the deal.
Right. Okay. That makes sense. Then the spirit of the question really, though, is how do we think about returns? And if, and I know in the past you and your comparables have all said that, that leverage has become less and less of a factor in what your expected returns are. Would you still say that's the case? And do we need to start worrying about having to put a higher percentage of equity in, lowering the IRR expectations for these deals?
I would say I would expect we'll put a higher percentage of equity in, but I do not expect it will lower the IRR.
I would also say that in a zero interest rate environment, investors around the world that I talk to all the time, they are seeing no other asset class that can get rates of return close to what private equity can get. And therefore, while we don't expect our rates of return will come down, I think investors are actually willing to accept somewhat lower rates of return because everything else they find is just so much lower.
The final point is if you look at kind of the portfolio and how we drive value, there's three basic levers you pull. It's can you grow up profitability, it's leverage or debt pay down, and then it's multiple expansion. And two-thirds of what we've done historically really has come from improving profitability, improving cash flow. So the amount that you lever, you know, yes, it's a component, but it's by far not the largest component. Large component is driving profitability.
Makes sense. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. And we have a question from the line of Michael Kim with Sandler O'Neill. Your line is now open.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my follow-up. Kurt, I know you talked about the outlook for fee-related earnings this year, but I think I heard you also mention expectations for lower fee revenues this year. Is that mostly a function of lower catch-up management fees and maybe lower hedge fund-related fees? Just trying to get a sense of that dynamic, particularly in the context of the three new funds turning on at the end of last quarter. Thanks.
Michael, that's spot on correct. You know, if you, you know, you look at the press release, we had about $73 million of catch-up management fees in 2015. That number is not going to recur at anywhere near that number, and that's going to be the majority of the decrease in revenues. You'll see some decrease also in, you know, the world bank in terms of the decrease in fees from the hedge funds, but, you know, that doesn't contribute anywhere near the same amount of profitability. So it's mostly the catch-up management fees that's really driving the top-line number.
Got it. Okay. Thanks for clearing that up. Thanks.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Bill Katz with Citi. Your line is now open.
Hey, thanks. Just a two-part unrelated question, I guess. The first one, in the press release, you sort of noted that just given the uncertainty around the reserve you built about whether that would flow through distributable earnings. So if, in fact, that were to be an adverse outcome, should we assume that at some point that that would be a hit to the distribution? And then sort of unrelated question, just on the GMS side, thanks for providing the redemption dynamic, but can you sort of step back and just talk about how the rest of the business might be faring? You mentioned the high watermark. Can you help maybe clarify what kind of return is needed to sort of get back into carry on that part of the business? Thank you.
Sure, Bill. So on the first part of the question on the reserve, you know, if I knew exact timing of when it would happen, you know, we probably would have run it through DE, but I don't know when or exactly how this will play out. So, but if we obviously end up paying something, it'll go through distributable earnings. Second item on GMS, you know, we have spent a lot of money this year in terms of building out our energy mezzanine team, both on a global basis and then on raising that $2.7 billion of capital that's already been raised. That fee number now turns on, so I'm expecting much higher fees from that product line, especially as we continue to raise it. We'll also be raising our fourth distress fund. That, too, will generate fees. And the BDC and the CLO continue, the CLO business continues to grow, as does the BDC, also contributors. And then, you know, offsetting that a little bit is some of the runoff on the hedge funds, but I will point out that, you know, they contributed $8 million of performance fees in the last quarter, and their performance is getting better.
Okay.
I might just add a little more. This is Bill. I might add a little more to that. And, you know, obviously our biggest hedge fund at one time was Claren Rowe. That no longer is the Emergent Sovereign Group of funds. Family of funds is bigger than Clarin Road. The Clarin Road performance lately has been good, but the funds remain well below their high water mark, on the order of 15% to 20%. I would say that most of that money, though, now has been a lot of that money anyway, that remains in the Clarin Road funds. People have agreed to lockups on the order of a year, so we have a chance to really continue to perform there. And in ESG, the funds there, they vary from, at or above their high water mark, if I can call it that, or approximately, or in some cases they might be well below as well. But it's got a bunch of niche strategies that worked out pretty well in the current environment.
Bill, I am disappointed you haven't asked my fee question. I prepared all week for this. So
answer it anyway, David.
I'm going to answer it, Russ. I did make a speech in London, and I was asked in a student group about innovation in private equity, and I said that it may be the case that somebody might come along and try to disrupt the models that the established firms have, and maybe if they were going to get started, they might change the construct that we have. But it is not my view that the major firms, the type that you're talking to, and a firm like ours, needs to change our basic business model for our core products. And so I don't see any pressure on the basic management fee right now, and I don't see any pressure at all on the carried interest of 20% on our basic products. I do think that after the Great Recession, there was more leverage by the limited partners on general partners more than there ever had been. And as a result of that, you did see deal fees go away largely. You saw preferred returns stay reasonably high, and fees or carries on co-investment largely went away. But today, I think we're in an equilibrium with the limited partners. I think it's generally recognized that we have a product that gets pretty good rates of return. So when we're now raising funds, we're not really dealing with the basic management fee issue or the carried interest issue, and I don't think we will in the future either.
Okay. Thanks, David. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And I'm not showing any further questions at this time. I would now like to turn the call back to Mr. Daniel Harris for closing remarks.
Thank you for your time today and your interest in the Carlyle Group. If you have any further questions, feel free to reach out to me or Investor Relations, and we look forward to talking to you next quarter.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for participating in today's conference. This does conclude the program, and you may all disconnect. Everyone have a great day.